My name is Leah Brownlee. I am, myself and Seth Oswood, both of Squire Pat Dogs, are hosting the webinar today. This is Corporate Basics for Startups, so thank you everybody for calling in. Right now, everybody that's called in is on mute, so if you have any questions, there should be an option to type the questions in, and we will try to get to your questions during the webinar, and if we don't, we will follow up with you afterwards. To quickly introduce ourselves, I am of counsel at Squire Patton Boggs in the Cleveland, Ohio office. My background is working with startups. The first startup I worked at was about 20 years ago when I was in college, and since then I have worked at both startups and worked on the legal side of things in a tech transfer department and in big law. Seth is a second-year associate that works with me with a number of the startup clients, advising on the corporate side of things, doing financing transactions, and just starting the companies and setting them up with their initial contracts and advising them throughout that process. This is our initial webcast. It will happen every month going forward. It will be the second Monday of every month in the afternoon. And I want to say thank you to our sponsors. We have worked with a number of organizations to help kind of get the word out for this initial webinar, and we had a live event on Friday. And up on your screen are the organizations that initiated and are the starting co-sponsors.
All right. Hi, everyone. This is Seth. I'm going to be talking about getting started. So let's say you have a great idea for a service or a product, and you think it's going to bring value to people and people want it, and you're thinking about starting a business. So the first step seems kind of obvious, but it's also important, is to form a legal entity. And so there's a lot of options at this point. You can form a corporation or a limited liability company or a partnership, and so it's really important to consider planning at this stage. The idea is to have a roadmap of where you want your company to go and have a cohesive story to tell investors. So it's important to think, you know, where you want your company down the line and how you think about developing it and how you want your investment to come in. And considering those, you'll be able to choose your entity appropriately and set yourself up for success. So we're going to be focusing on limited liability companies and corporations because those are the two most common, and more specifically, corporations are most common for startups for reasons we'll get to in just a second. So this slide focuses on the difference between corporations and limited liability companies. So one reason corporations are often the default choice is because so many companies choose to incorporate, and it's become well-known and familiar not only to investors but also to lawyers and just business community in general. However, an LLC may be a better choice depending on the nature of your business that you're forming. So, depending on what kind of product or services you want to offer or how you expect to grow, an LLC might be a better choice for you. And part of that reason, and one of the main reasons people start off as LLCs or limited liability companies, is what we call pass-through taxation on this slide, which is essentially that corporations are taxed at their revenue and when they pay dividends to stockholders. So that structure is set up where it's essentially a double tax, whereas in an LLC, an individual owner or the individual owners report those taxes on their personal income. So you don't get taxed twice on the revenue coming to the LLC, which is an advantage. However, this may be a deterrent because it limits your options for creating different classes or creating different kinds of equity to sell, and this may hinder your investment. So other things just touching base on corporations are, as I mentioned earlier, if they're familiar and the governance structure of a formation may be familiar to some, you know, there's a board of directors, there's officers, and however, you don't have much flexibility with that. The requirements are really pretty strict, but everyone knows them and they're easy to manage. I mentioned the taxation and familiarity to investors. Limited liability companies offer a more flexible governance structure. You have more, you can kind of set it up however you want. In your formation documents, you can structure it where the owners are also the officers and also the board, and you kind of do everything, and you have flexibility. You could even set it up to be to closely resemble a corporation. And it's important to know both, most importantly, and one of the main reasons, I don't know if I mentioned earlier, that why you form the entity is they provide limited liability protection. So if something happens to go wrong, you don't hope, which obviously you aren't hoping for, but something goes wrong, the owners are protected under both structures.
Right, so you're limited to the amount of money that you put into the company, of what you're going to lose, not your personal assets, so long as you've managed the money correctly and not mixed your personal money with the company's money.
Yeah, that's right. And I'll get to later, to ensure that you're protected, it's important to follow good governance practices. Another option for starting your company is to form an S-Corp. So an S-Corp, you have the same structure as a regular corporation, but the tax treatment is the same as the LLC. So you don't have the double taxation I mentioned earlier. You have the pass-through as in an LLC, but you have the same corporate structure. However, with an S-Corp, you have less options for creating classes of stock, which may, again, be a deterrent or limit your options for investment down the line. Okay. So another thing when you're starting your corporation or your business, your legal entity, your startup company, is to consider which state you want to form your company in. And again, we are focusing here on corporations because they're the default choice a lot of times and the most common. And that's why we have Delaware up here, because most corporations are formed in Delaware. And the reason for that is because a lot of corporations are formed in Delaware. So because of the long history of corporations being formed there, there's developed a wide body of corporate case law there, and so the law is very predictable and easy to understand, and over time the law has also become pretty friendly to businesses. So the combination of these things has led to a lot of corporations incorporating there. Other advantages of incorporating in Delaware include ease of filing and the online services available, lower franchise taxes, and it'll be familiar to investors. A lot of times investors, when looking at companies, will want to see that you're a Delaware company because they understand how Delaware corporate law works and they'll understand the structure. However, you may consider forming your company in the same state as you operate your business in. So we have up here Ohio as an example, assuming maybe you're going to form a company that will be operating in Ohio. A disadvantage is that less corporations are formed here, so you'll have less predictable law. However, you'll have the convenience of operating your business and incorporating in the same state. So this saves on some of the administrative fees and burden of dealing with multiple state filings, which can be a hassle. Specifically, One of those filings is that if you incorporate in a different state than where you operate, you need to file a foreign business license, which does have a small fee, but it is a fee nonetheless. And there's a potential, too, that state laws are favorable in the state you're operating in, such as Ohio.
And I want to just make a point here. One of the reasons we chose Ohio is because of a very new and favorable state law in the cybersecurity area that will go into effect on November 2nd. And that's applied to any case that Ohio law is applicable in, where it gives an affirmative defense to a company that's been hacked if they've had the right privacy standards on their data. And so Ohio seems a little bit out of place for choosing for the state of formation, but particularly because of that new law, we want to point out a new favorable state law that we're working with that happens to be a first in the nation law.
So if that's something important to you, might consider Ohio. There's also the social perception that if you have a lot of Ohio customers or you're looking to be in Ohio, you could take pride in the fact that you're an Ohio company.
So turning back to Delaware, though, because most companies are formed there, just as an example, talking about the formation costs, a Delaware corporation can be formed online, whether you're a founder or using an attorney. And there's a lot of legal services online, or you can go to a law firm such as the one that we work for. The example costs that I'm giving you are the ones that we use out of the law firm. And so when I'm forming a company, it's about $1,000 for the first set of filings. And what you see up there on the list of formation documents is what we charge companies about $1,000 to complete for them, and those are the original formation documents that a company needs. And then following that, we talk about what the cost is for franchise tax. We have the actual numbers there for Delaware, which is for an LLC, it's $300 a year. The corporation, it's dependent upon the number of shares that that corporation has authorized. And it can be dependent on revenue as well. Delaware has a very easy-to-use franchise tax calculator on their website, but the minimal cost for franchise tax is $225 a year, and that's at 5,000 shares authorized or less. Because we're talking about Delaware, and almost inevitably nobody sits within the state of Delaware when they're forming a Delaware corporation, we have an added cost, which isn't a lot, but shouldn't be forgotten, which is that service provider in Delaware that allows you to have a Delaware address for your company and takes all of your mail and correspondence with the state and brings it from the state of Delaware and sends it to you for responses, too. You also use them for the formation documents, anything that gets filed with the state of Delaware. A quick overview on what those formation documents are, in case you're not familiar. Just going down the line, the certificate of incorporation is the primary governance document of the company. This gets filed with the state, so it's a public document. The bylaws is a different governance document of the company. It is secondary to the certificate of incorporation, which means that if there's a conflict between the bylaws and the certificate of incorporation, what is in the certificate of incorporation is what governs. The bylaws are adopted typically by the directors of the company, and any changes to the bylaws are adopted by the directors, where the certificate of incorporation is adopted and amended by the stockholders of the company. The next item, it's an organizational action of the incorporator. Probably sounds fairly unfamiliar. Typically, the incorporator is a person who is doing the original filing. So when I'm handling this for a client, I'm always the incorporator. And I do that first action, which is actually to establish the board of directors. And I do the action of filing the certificate of incorporation on behalf of the client to form the company. And so that first action, it's about a page long, is something that I would sign in my role with the company. The next one is the EIN. That's an employee identification number. That's a number issued by the IRS. And every company needs it to open bank accounts, file taxes, et cetera. And we obtain that number from the IRS on behalf of the company. Then we have the first board action, and this is typically done in writing rather than at a meeting. A number of things are done on that action. It's really approval and adoption of the bylaws, approval of who's going to own the stock of the company, allowing the company to do things such as opening a bank account, filing that foreign filing, kind of the real basics of the company. And we just do that in the first action that's signed by the original board of directors. Next, we have a subscription agreement and the stock certificate. Those go hand in hand. Subscription agreement is a basic agreement, usually a page or two long, where the founders make representations that are required by U.S. securities laws and essentially say that they're qualified under the U.S. securities laws to own the stock. And usually that qualification happens because they're executives at the company is how they come in. And the next is the stock certificate. Under Delaware law, you do not have to issue a stock certificate, but if the company decides to, it should. There's a formality to the stock certificate, and it's signed by two officers of the company.
Next, we want to touch base on some basics about corporate governance. And again, we're talking about corporations. If you decided to form an LLC, you have a lot more flexibility in this area. But it's important that when forming a company, you understand just some basic principles of corporate governance. And I think it's a good idea to just instill good practice from the beginning, because if you get in the habit of doing things correctly down the line, it's much easier when the company eventually grows and becomes a little more complicated. And also, investors like to see that the company is well run, and it makes them more comfortable generally. So basic structure of a corporation is there's a board of directors, there's officers, and there's shareholders or owners. And so all three groups have different roles. The shareholders, although it's not on the slide, the shareholders are responsible for approving the biggest decisions for the company, such as electing board of directors or approving a sale of the company, something of that nature. The board is responsible for other major decisions, and they elect the officers and will approve major contracts, things like that. Every corporation is required to have at least one member of the board or one director, and the board of directors has to act in the interest of the corporation. So if this would take you to conflicts of interest, so if a board member, it might be, you know, you might have a contract with a company that's owned by a board member, that you have to take careful action to make sure that director is acting in the interest of the company and not him or herself. Officers take charge of the day-to-day operations. This is your CEO or your president or secretary or treasurer, and they carry out the policies and plans that are put forth by the board. All corporations in Delaware are required to have a president and a secretary at a minimum, but it's important to know that this can be the same person. So individuals can hold multiple officer positions, but are required to act in the capacity of those roles.
The So next step, we have a quick summary of the types of corporate governance paperwork. As Seth mentioned, you know, we always recommend kind of keeping your house in order from the beginning. And corporate governance is probably falls within the category of things that founders don't want to deal with. And it's an extra thing to do at the end of the day when they're doing product development, trying to find investors, et cetera, trying to do everything they can to make their company successful. The last thing anybody wants to do is the paperwork and the filing. Notwithstanding that, it's a lot easier down the line when it doesn't get neglected, and it is kept up. And that's, you know, when it comes to getting investors, going through due diligence, an investor probably will wait a couple days to see your board minutes, but it's going to start raising red flags if they have to wait a couple weeks to see them. And I've definitely, in my career, had a number of times where maybe the board minutes didn't exist for several years of a company's life, or the board minutes were really handwritten notes that the person who was designated as the secretary at the beginning then had to turn into an official board, you know, set of board minutes because an investment was coming in. And these are hard times, and they end up costing more legal dollars at those times than the founders and the company would have planned or wanted to spend. Going back to the structure of it, though, the general structure of the corporate governance paperwork is kept within what's called a minute book. Mostly these days, these are electronic, though there are still a number of hard copy books with soft copy, you know, mirrors of those books around at clients. And what's within the minute book falls within, you know, four general categories. We have our organizational docs that we talked about earlier and the state filings. And these are receipts that are coming back from the state that you made the filing in. And those get saved in one section. We have board minutes. And this is a general documented summary of what happened at the board meeting. And generally, board minutes are not details. They just document that the meeting occurred, who attended the meeting, the general matters that were discussed, that those matters were actually discussed, and then the general matters that were decided, but not the back and forth between each of the board members. Then we have shareholder minutes in young companies. These usually happen when the lawyer that's helping do a deal tell you that they need to be signed. And short of that, they should happen one time a year to re-elect the board. But they don't typically start happening more frequently than once a year or upon a big financing event until the company is more mature. And sometimes they don't happen more frequently than once a year then. And then the next section is the records of the stock that's issued. If the company issues stock certificates, the company should either keep the actual stock certificates for the founders, say if they were issued to them, or keep copies of them. And they should, if they're copies, they should be marked as copies. They also keep the subscription agreements that are signed, and those are the agreements to buy the stock that make the representations that say that the investor, you know, qualifies under the different SEC rules. And then evidence of payment for the shares. We see very often that the shares might not actually be paid for, and the reason is at most they cost a couple dollars at the beginning. But we like to see on the books and the finances that somebody actually wrote a check, transferred money over to the company, and paid for shares. And from a good housekeeping perspective, keeping a copy of that check next to the subscription agreement is just good housekeeping and shows some evidence of it. Yeah, and you know, as I mentioned earlier, it's something that people don't like to do. It's the last thing to do at the end of the day of product development, but it does make life easier in the long run, especially doing due diligence down the line if these records are kept up to date. And another thing to note, startups are always on a budget. That being said, they also like using, they're usually very technologically savvy, and so if there's some new and easier way to help them manage these, they will use it. And there are different filing systems. For the stock records, board minutes, et cetera, Carta is a very popular one. But those who are bootstrapping it and don't want to pay any money, Excel works fine. The online, you know, file folder services work fine to keep the file records and share them. And you really can do it on the very, very cheap and keep records. And do a good job keeping the records if you need to. Not spend your dollars there. The next item, and this goes along with kind of the paperwork, what we like to do when we're advising companies is really add value from the legal perspective. We don't want the startup companies spending their money paying our fees. We want them spending their money developing their products. So to enable that, we really need to keep the legal costs down and enable our clients to do that. To do this, we have what we call a playbook, and we give our clients forms of different types of documents that their business will need as they develop. And we can, you know, create new forms as the business is further developed, as they go out to new customers. Depending on what their business plan is, we'll work with them on the timing for when they need what documents. We've listed out some of the basic forms that we typically see going out. And I want to point out the most important of all of these being the non-disclosure agreement. Typically, startup companies are formed around high technology, possibly patentable technology, and protecting the ability to patent that technology is very important to that company's ability to succeed in the future. And so every time they, you know, collaborate with someone on the technology, hire a new consultant, hire a new employee, go looking for an investor, you know, a number of reasons why they would be having conversations about their technology with a third person. They really should be looking for signing a non-disclosure agreement if those conversations start going into the realm of the confidential parts of the technology and, you know, why it works and, you know, like what would make that technology valuable to the company. So with those basics covered, we want to walk through a quick hypothetical. And we're starting at day zero for the hypothetical. So we have two founders, Jenny and Tim, and they have what most early stage companies have, which is an innovative solution to a common problem. And they want to monetize that innovative solution and start a company so they can sell it to people and start solving that common problem for everybody, not just themselves. That being said, Tim has a real job. And he doesn't want to lose his salary, so he's going to stay there. He's going to keep on working at the research institution. Jenny, however, has some more flexibility. Maybe she's a little less, you know, risk adverse, and she's okay to go work at the startup from the very beginning, full-time basis, and putting all of her efforts into that. And, you know, so right here, we have a technology, we have two founders that have different amounts of time to spend in developing the technology and developing the company. And so those founders really need to sit down and understand how they want to split the company. It might not be 50-50. Jenny's doing all the work, so maybe she gets more of the equity. That being said, maybe Tim's the inventor. He's really the brains behind the technology, and Jenny's happy to split it and values his, you know, intellectual value add as 50% of the company. And that's something that the founders are going to decide. And they really should think about, you know, that, because while it can be shifted in the future, there can be tax consequences if it's shifted in the future. If there aren't, you know, other consequences of just the relationship between the founders, if one believes that they didn't get a fair part of the company at the beginning. If the founders want, they can put in agreements in place at this point in time that say, you know, that the shares vest over time. So they have to work for so long to actually have the ownership in the company. And this, you know, is often seen when you have, you know, a group of founders, and they want to protect from the what if scenarios. You know, what if this person leaves after 6 months? We don't know him well enough. We don't know how well it's going to work out. And we can put agreements in place that protect from those scenarios, that allow the company to buy the stock back, that give that person, you know, less vested stock, meaning he owns less at the moment he leaves. And so that's a conversation between the founders. And then, you know, when all of these what-ifs come up, it really is a conversation also with the lawyers and the flexibility of what kind of agreements we can put in place to protect from the scenarios that they're discussing. The next question is, what are the legal actions required to start a company? So Seth has covered this earlier. You know, when the founders decided what the type of product they have, they look at what their company is going to look like in 3 years, 5 years, and it's going to start becoming fairly clear what type of company form they're going to go after. And, you know, they may need a few conversations with lawyers to figure out the right form. But then, you know, once it's decided who's going to own how much, who's going to play what role within the company as far as executives, who's going to be on the board, we might be ready to start the company. And so we can file the initial paperwork with the company name in the right state, and for the right entity type on behalf of the company. And then the next question, and this follows the type of company, you know, how is the company getting funded? If it's a consulting company, we might be forming an LLC. But for most of the companies where we're making a product that we want a big company to come in and buy us later, or we want to take it all the way to market, we're probably forming a regular corporation, and we're probably looking for someone to help us help fund that first, you know, creation and prototyping of the product. And that funding may come in a different number of different ways. Typically, we see two of those three buckets coming in really early. Debt in the form of a convertible note, though often we see what's called SAFEs, which is a simple agreement for future equity. Very similar, but there's not a maturity date. Both the convertible note and the SAFE documents are kind of the simple, easy ones to do up front, just from a legal document perspective. They cost a lot less money. The other thing we see are grants, whether it's from that research institution or federal. There's a lot of grant opportunities out there that would be called non-dilutive, because the granting agency doesn't take any stock in the new company. And they give grants, and it may be from getting it from idea stage to kind of a proof of concept grant. But there's a lot of small grant opportunities out there that will help with the development, pay for the development process. Moving, you know, down the line, the company's been formed. They have a little bit of money. They know who their executive team is. They know who their board is. And now they have a couple of employees. So maybe we're up to 3 or 4 people that are working for the company, whether in a consulting role or an employee role. Friends and family have given a little bit of money, so we have money to pay some salaries. We've also received some grants. And we have some people that really believe in our technology and want to help us in the mentoring role or as board members. So now we're at a point where, going with the last one, we might be expanding our board, you know, so it's not just the 2 founders. We might add somebody as a board member in the mentor kind of role. Say, if we're talking about a medical device company, that board member might be our champion within the local medical institution. So here in Cleveland, we have Cleveland Clinic. So it is fairly frequent that we see, you know, the head of some part of the surgery department going in as a board member for a medical device company where, you know, he has a lot of knowledge of what's seen in that surgical theater and a lot of practical advice that can be given to that company, and they value that. We also mentioned employees, consultants. So now we have some agreements with people, whether it's an offer letter, a consulting agreement. We've agreed what they're going to do for us, how much we're going to pay them. And hopefully we've written that down into a document that also says that we own all the intellectual property that they're developing. If we're in a state like Ohio versus a state like California or Washington, we're also going to put things in there that say you can't work for our competitors, not only while you're working for us, but also maybe for a year afterward. Now, if you're in a state like California, we're not going to put that in there for the after employment because it's against public policy. But we are going to say it about while you're currently employed for us. We have some initial investment documents, some more legal paperwork that we have to keep track of. And if they're in the form of convertible notes, we're also going to be keeping track of when they're due and how much interest is, you know, being accumulated on in them. And our finance person, which probably at this point is maybe a scientist that doesn't mind dabbling in accounting, maybe a local small CPA firm that's helping us with our bookkeeping for a fee per month, but probably not a CFO and not a solid probably not a career finance person at this point. So we're probably running our finances in Excel or QuickBooks, something fairly basic. But we are going to be wanting to keep track of interest that's accumulating on any loans that we took, making sure we have our eye on the dates those become due. And also, how fast are we using the money that we have in our bank account? And when are we going to need to start looking for more? Because we don't want to start looking for more money when we ran out of money. We want to start, you know, a few months before we're going to run out of money to make sure that we can still, you know, pay our employees and, very importantly, pay the IRS our taxes and pay the service providers, you know, but most important, always, employees and the IRS. And so, you know, we're moving forward, we're developing, there's more governance there, which takes more time. But, you know, Jenny and Tim need to manage this, and they're really protecting themselves by keeping their eye on all of this paperwork and spending a little bit of time on it so they know what's going on with the financing, when things are due, making sure they sign the documents, keep copies of them, kind of making sure they're managing the company, not just working on product development all the time. So going forward a little bit more, the company's going good. We got investors interested. People are excited. We have employees that are really bought into this technology. They love it. And Jenny and Tim, they really like these guys. They feel like they're very loyal. They want to share some of their ownership with them. So starting with that fact, we're going to start talking to a lawyer probably about putting in an employee incentive plan. Or an equity incentive plan. So we have a lot of people that might have been giving consulting advice for free. We have employees that are working hard that love the company. And we want to give them a little piece of the pie before that pie is really expensive, because they're really valuable to the company, and we want them to have an opportunity to make money when the stock grows and the company successfully exits as well. And so we put in this equity incentive plan in working with a lawyer to do that. And we'd like to do this under the formal plan that gets adopted by the shareholders, because when we do it the formal way, there's a good tax benefit to the employees that are receiving stock options under it. So they can delay paying taxes. They don't pay taxes when they exercise their stock options. They then pay taxes only when they sell them. So it's a great benefit. And there's other type of equity that can be delineated out of that plan, whether it's restricted stock that says, somebody needs to work for a couple of years before they get full ownership. This is another set of kind of form documents as the company grows up that we can help the company with. And that really companies, like to put out, and so they can incentivize employees to keep working hard. Because the harder that employee or that consultant that gets those shares works, presumably the more money the company's worth, and so their hard work turns into dollars. So the next fact at this stage is we have a prototype, and we have some data. Let's say we're a medical device company. We're probably getting to the stage where we're going to stop developing our prototype and start talking to the FDA. But we have to stop in the development stage so that we have a device that's going to the FDA and looking for approval. We could still be working in the lab on it, and we can have a next generation device, but we have to stop on one and then start a new version. So that device probably has patents on it, and if it doesn't have patents on it, it's going to very soon, because starting to talk to a patent attorney about how to protect that and kind of hold the value of that device so that it creates value for the company. And all that data that we're bringing in is going in the patent applications, it's going to the FDA, being put in investor presentations, it's proving that there's value in the product that the company's making, and there's a reason to invest. So I kind of walked through commercialization a bit there. With our example med device company, we want to commercialize the product. We figured out the regulatory path, where a type 2 or a type 3 medical device, so we have to talk to the FDA and get their authorization before we can sell it into the open marketplace. So we have to know what the path is to selling it to the ultimate customer. The other way this new med device company might be commercializing their product is they're going out to other med device companies that are bigger than them, and they're partnering with those companies. And they're having these talks, and they're starting the conversation about who is the best partner to develop it all the way to market, which brings into us the idea of the NDA again. Those companies might be coming in on investment rounds. We might be talking about distribution agreements at this point. It really depends on where we are in the development path. And next, we have to raise money again. We got to a value-added milestone with the prototype and the data. We have a few months of cash left in the bank. Hopefully 3 to 6 months or more at this point, so we're not going to be rushing the investors to go through their due diligence, but trying to move them forward at a good pace. And we're going to be talking about the first round of, like, serious investment documents, full-blown stock purchase agreements, stockholders agreements, investor rights agreements, and, you know, venture capital money coming in. So the company is getting serious, it's growing up, and it's becoming a company that has a valuable product with investors that aren't just friends and family, that really believe that they can bring this product to market or to a stage where it can add a lot of value. And because we're talking about startup companies, we're stopping at that point. So that's the end of the presentation. If anybody has any questions, feel free to type them in. For everybody on the line, we do this once a month. We do a live version and a webinar. So our next live version is October 5th. It's in Cleveland, Ohio. The webinar will be the following Monday, October 8th, from 6 to 7 p.m. again. And my apologies for having slides out of order, but going back to the hypothetical, I guess the takeaways are, you know, keep up with your corporate governance. It'll make your life easier. Minimize your legal costs by planning ahead, using form documents, and just, you know, planning along the way really helps the company and its development. So the contact information for both of the speakers, myself and Seth, is up there, and we're happy to share it via email afterward as well. Any questions? I'll give a minute or so before we close down the webinar if you would like to type a question in. Well, thank you, everyone, for your time. And thank you for joining us, and have a good evening.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude our conference. We do appreciate your participation. You may disconnect at this time. Thank you. Have a great night.